I want to thank you for coming out tonight. Weather's not great. As we'll get into, Iraq does have its problems, but the weather is better than in Rochester here. I want to be clear from the start that the notion that the United States has brought freedom and happiness to Iraqis is a lie. I knew that before going to Iraq, but to actually see this occupation with my own eyes, it makes the lies that the U.S. government used to sell this war so much more sick and infuriating. The overall impression that I got during my week in Iraq, and the sense that I want to convey to you tonight, is that Iraqis have lost and continue to lose really control over their country and over their lives. The loss of this control happens in big ways, like when a loved one is detained or killed by U.S. troops. It happens in smaller but still important ways, like when you're trying to get somewhere and you get in your car to drive and you find out that the United States has closed the road and so you have to find a detour. Or if you're a student trying to study for your exams and the lights go out. So in big ways and in small ways, this occupation is affecting everyone in Iraq. What I want to do tonight is share with you conversations that I had with people and the things that I experienced with my own eyes to give you a general sense of this occupation and why it's so important for us to end it immediately. I want to start with Tadek. He was our driver from Amman to Baghdad. There are no commercial airlines flying in or out of Iraq right now, so we had to fly to Amman, Jordan, and then land there and drive 13 hours into Baghdad. So I spoke with Tadek, who was our driver, and he was like many Iraqis who I would meet, in that initially he was hopeful that good would come out of this invasion. He wasn't against the war from the start. And I think that it's important to understand the invasion of Iraq and the occupation in some historical context. It's coming at the end of 35 years of dictatorship by Saddam Hussein and 20 years of war. And just to go through that briefly, in the 1980s, Iraq had a war with Iran, which was absolutely catastrophic. It killed about 1 million people between Iraq and Iran. Everyone in Iraq, every family in Iraq lost someone in that war. I mean, it was just across the board really devastating. In 1991, the United States invaded, of course, in what we call here the Gulf War. And that invasion destroyed infrastructure. Civilian infrastructure was targeted. Between 100 and 200,000 Iraqis were killed in that invasion, so that was devastating. At the same time as that was going on, President Bush Sr. imposed an embargo on Iraq that was referred to as economic sanctions. That is, it restricted trade with Iraq, and a lot of goods couldn't be traded. A lot of basic things like clothing, medicine, basic construction materials weren't allowed into Iraq, and it was imposed to the United Nations by the U.S. And so really, Iraq was starved throughout the whole 1990s because these materials weren't allowed in. During that period, by the way, the United States and the United Kingdom were flying missions. The U.S. and U.K. set up no-fly zones where Iraqi Air Force couldn't fly, but U.S. and British Air Force could, and they were actually bombing positions in Iraq throughout that 13-year period. At times, they were bombing once a week, so it wasn't a peaceful time. So this is 20 years of war that they're coming out of right now, and Tadek was hoping that the U.S. invasion would end these years of war and suffering. And he was really willing to give the U.S. the benefit of the doubt. He was really hopeful about it. What he told me, though, was that the U.S. simply brought more war and more suffering. And I think it's important to make a distinction between the way he saw the invasion and the way I saw it. I was against the invasion from the start. I thought that the idea that the United States, which has brought so much suffering to Iraq for so long, all of a sudden now cares about Iraq and wants to bring freedom, I figured that doesn't make any sense. And this is only bad can come out of this. And Tadek didn't view it that way. He really was willing to give the United States the benefit of the doubt. And I think that the result is that in addition to the anger that Tadek feels, you know, which is anger that I feel too about, you know, I knew this was going to be bad and it's going to be bad, Tadek also feels a sense of betrayal that he actually had his hopes up and the U.S. lied to him. They said they were going to bring freedom and peace and instead they brought this occupation. Tadek's brother was killed in the invasion. And then there was the occupation, and Tadek told me about his anger regarding that, how the United States has failed to bring work to Iraq, has failed to reconstruct infrastructure destroyed, has failed to restore electricity, access to clean water, or security. The economy is in shambles. I read last week in The Guardian, which is a British newspaper, that the unemployment rate in Iraq right now is around 80%, which is astronomical. And he told me, you know, we just want to live. he told me about how much he loves this country, how he doesn't want to live elsewhere. He wants to live in his home in Iraq. But we don't want the Army USA, he said. That's what they call the Army. That's what he calls the Army. And he was asking me, why are they still here? They got rid of Saddam's regime. Why are they still here? Why won't they leave? Throughout the drive, the things that Tadek told me, it was a 13-hour drive, so we had a lot of time to talk. They really gave me some insight in terms of how Iraqis are suffering under this occupation, but it really couldn't compare to me actually seeing it with my own eyes. After crossing into Iraq, I saw U.S. troops for the first time. There was an armored vehicle on the road, the same road that we were on, and there was a U.S. soldier sticking out of the top, and he was wearing a ski mask, and he had a huge gun. He was behind this huge gun that he had pointed at the different cars on the road. He looked terrifying, and I can only imagine what he looks like to Iraqis, whose country they're occupying. There was another vehicle and another soldier and another gun in front of his, and then we saw the reason why they were on the road. Out in front of them stretched out a long convoy of oil tanker trucks that were going into Baghdad. And then at the head of the convoy were another two escort vehicles. Since we're talking about an oil convoy, I want to just talk a bit about the oil and gas situation in Iraq. The U.S. is, as this situation suggests, the U.S. is actually importing gasoline into Iraq. This is strange, you may say, as Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world. As we were on the drive, we actually had to stop for gasoline, and we had to wait for 45 minutes in line just to get gas. Now, this is unimaginable in the United States. I mean, can you imagine people waiting 45 minutes at the Hess station on Jefferson Road, outside of here? And if it's unimaginable here, it was completely inconceivable in Iraq. At one point in Iraq, gas was actually cheaper than water. When we were on the road, I saw a column of smoke rising up from the ground at one point. I was wondering, what is that? Was there an attack and vehicles are on fire, or what is it? And it turns out that oil was just coming out of the ground and it caught on fire. I mean, that's how much oil there is in Iraq. It's just, you take a rock and there's oil everywhere. So for them to be importing gasoline, not only is it absurd, but it's a source of incredible bitterness for Iraqis. So our 45-minute wait was nothing. In Baghdad, people are waiting 5 and 6 hours for gasoline, and a lot of people are actually driving to the gas stations at night with blankets and thermoses, camping out so they can get gas in the morning. So, this is really absurd, and it's an immense source of anger for Iraqi people. It's not that Iraq isn't producing oil. We saw oil refineries running and everything. It's just that the oil isn't there. As we got closer to Baghdad, we saw a prison, which looked terrifying, as prisons do, that had high fortified walls and guard towers and razor wire everywhere. And this was Abu Ghraib prison. This prison was notorious under Saddam Hussein, and now it's the main detention facility of the United States and the occupation. The prison essentially is four fortified walls and then a big courtyard with plastic tents in the center. And this is where the prisoners stay. They stay in these tents during the day, and they stay there at night, and they stay there in the winter. When I was there, it got down below freezing, and they stay in these plastic tents in the summer where it gets, the temperature goes in excess of 120 degrees. So it's a pretty bleak situation. Upon entering Baghdad, I was really blown away by the sight of bombed out buildings everywhere. And I have some photos in the back on the table that I'd like to show you if you're interested afterward, some of the pictures of the bombed out buildings. But it's really impossible to convey what it feels like to stand before a 15-story high-rise that's a shell because it's been bombed out and shelled by U.S. tanks. And yet they're still standing. Among the bombed-out buildings I saw were the Ministry of Culture, a supermarket, an apartment building, and the telephone exchange, what we used to be the telephone exchange. It's nearly leveled. That was across the street from the hotel that I stayed in. The effects of the economic sanctions that I talked about before were even more apparent. I mean, there were bombed out buildings dotting Baghdad, but the effects of the sanctions were everywhere. Because basic construction materials couldn't be traded with Iraq, buildings are just kind of falling apart, they're crumbling. And in many cases, systems like sewage systems and power grids that were hanging by a thread because of the sanctions, the U.S. invasion in the spring was really kind of the final straw, and so they've collapsed. And so throughout Baghdad, there's sewage flowing in the streets. And, it was pretty overwhelming for me to see, but I can't imagine actually living in Baghdad so much of this has happened so quickly for them. Iraq wasn't always a third world country. It was a very modern, advanced country, and in a lot of ways it still is, but they've lost so much in such little time, and you really get the sense that this was such a majestic city. This is the cradle of civilization, you know, the Fertile Crescent, and yet there's sewage flowing in the streets. When we got into Baghdad, we hooked up with the Occupation Watch Center, which is a nonprofit organization based in Baghdad. And their program is drawing attention to the occupation for people outside of Iraq and also trying to organize on some level Iraqis within Iraq against the occupation. And they kind of designed our itinerary, and they had guides and translators who went with us throughout Baghdad throughout the week. And so the first meeting that they arranged for us was one with a family who had lost someone to U.S. forces. I'm going to tell you about that meeting. It's my first night in the city. The family invited us in and sat us down. The brother of the man who was killed told us the story. It happened on September 22nd. The man, Ahmed Khalif Salman, was accused of being part of the resistance. And right now, all it takes is an accusation that you're part of the resistance, and that's warrant for a detention to the U.S. The troops came at 3 in the morning. They blocked off the street of his house with tanks. One of them kicked down the outside door. When Ahmed opened the front door, they shot him in the chest immediately. They took him outside. He was still alive. And they let him lie bleeding in the front yard. And then they went into the house and ordered his family out of the house. Once the family was outside of the house, they ransacked it. They stole money. They stole jewelry. They broke furniture. Outside, Ahmed's son, who spoke to us, he must be like 13 years old. He was asking the soldiers what they were doing, why they'd hurt his father. And so the soldiers tied him up and they put him on the ground, this little kid. When they were done, they left the house, they wrapped Ahmed's wound crudely, and they grabbed him by his feet and dragged him to the vehicles, and they threw him into one of them, and they took off. His family had no idea where he was taken to. So they went searching at different detention centers and hospitals, and they found him at one hospital. He had died, and the U.S. troops just dropped off his body at the hospital. He was 46 years old, and he had 5 kids, and now his family lives in his brother's house. That's where we met. You know, his kids are terrified to sleep in the house where their father was killed. The U.S. going to people's houses for the purpose of detention is something that we're not hearing enough about in the United States. And we met another woman whose son was detained, and I want to tell you her story as well. Her name was Alam, and I'm sorry if I'm butchering these names. My Arabic isn't great. She was in the hospital the day before her son was detained, and she had kidney problems, and so she was on dialysis. She's an older woman. And again, the troops came in the night. This time they came at 4 in the morning. They kicked down the door, and they threw in a sound grenade in the middle of the night. And so they stormed the house, and it was the same thing. They ordered everyone out of the house. They went into her room, and I think that it's important to know how the disregard that the U.S. has for Iraqi culture in this situation. Men don't enter women's rooms in Iraq. Even a father, before entering his daughter's room, has to ask permission. So for Alam to wake up and find 18-year-old kids, men standing in her room, seeing her in her night clothes and yelling at her to get out of her bed, that's really, you know, aside from the obvious, I mean, that would be offensive here, but that's really offensive in Iraq. She tried to explain that she was sick, that she was in the hospital earlier that day, and that she couldn't get out of bed, but they told her to get out of bed, and so she did. Her son, Nabil, is 25. They detained him. Again, he's accused of being part of the resistance. That happened on November 8th, and when I talked to her, she still didn't know where he was. There are a lot of detention centers that the U.S. has in Iraq, and family members don't know to which their family members are taken. Nabil was Alam's only source of income. Her husband, who is still alive, but he's too old to work, and so Nabil was really providing the income for the household. And so now Alam is just surviving through the donations from her friends, and she's begging on the street. I also spoke with a woman who lost her family during the invasion, after speaking with Alam. And I think it's important to talk about this because here in the States, we were told that the invasion was done with surgical precision, that Ba'athists regime facilities were targeted, but that if you were a civilian, for the most part, you were safe in Baghdad. And that's not true. First of all, the U.S. used cluster bombs in Baghdad, which is a city of 4 million people. Cluster bombs are obviously, they're bombs that drop and then little bomblets drop around the area, and they're obviously designed to kill as many people as possible. This was in a city of 4 million people. But in addition to that, you had horror stories like Vivian Salim, the woman who I spoke with. On April 7th, her neighborhood came under attack by U.S. bombing. And so she and her husband, Nadim, got their kids, and they piled them into the car to flee the neighborhood. As they were driving through the streets, they turned down one street, and they found a U.S. tank in their path. Without warning, the tank opened fire. One of the people in my delegation asked Vivian if the U.S. fired any warning shots. And she broke down crying as she said that the first shot the tank fired landed in her son's face. She left the car. Her whole family was killed. Her husband and her three children were all killed by the tank fire. And so she ran away and escaped. There were other civilians killed in the area at the same time, and U.S. soldiers crudely took their bodies and buried them in that neighborhood. And so she had to go back and dig up her family and then give them a proper Muslim burial. So these are some of the horror stories that I heard. Just speaking with people whose family members are being killed or detained by U.S. troops. I also want to tell you a little about the health situation, or the healthcare situation, just a little. I visited two hospitals while I was in Baghdad, and they really didn't have the basics. I want to tell you about one in particular, the Qadamiya Hospital. Now, this doctor, who's a surgeon, Dr. Ala Yusuf, he's a young surgeon. Before we entered the hospital, he told us that this was one of the best, that this was a teaching hospital. So medical students in Iraq, to learn how to be doctors, they come to this hospital to do their residency. So it's one of the best in the country. And upon entering the building, we could see that, but before we even got to medical facilities, we could see that the general hospital was just in disrepair, that the walls were cracked, lights were missing from the ceiling, the place was filthy. A hospital should be as clean as possible. And so he took us in. We saw the medical facilities. They were lacking. They don't have basic things like oxygen tanks, so they're limited in the number of surgeries they can do because they don't have the oxygen to give people while they're being operated on. He also told us about the horrors of trying to run this hospital during the actual invasion. He told us about how they would lose power. He'd be in the middle of a surgery and then the electricity would go out, the lights would go out. At one point in the winter, they lost heat. And the hospitals in the neighborhood that's had a lower elevation than the rest of Baghdad. And so there's a pump system that's meant to pump wastewater out from the hospital and from the neighborhood up into the sewage treatment center. And due to the neglect under the sanctions, these pumps broke one by one during the invasion in the spring. It was kind of the final straw, and the whole system fell apart. And so you had sewage flowing back, and at one point Dr. Ala found himself operating as he stood in a pool of sewage, which is obviously not sterile environment. And speaking of lack of sterilization, they don't have the basic, they don't have an autoclave, which is a very basic instrument that's used to sterilize surgical instruments, and so they have to wash their scalpels and surgical instruments in tap water. This is a tap water that I wouldn't even drink. I was drinking bottled water the whole time. During the invasion, when they didn't have tap water, they washed their instruments in the river. So that gives you some sense of what the medical situation is like. And if you have questions like that, we can take that up in the discussion. I want to talk a little now about the contempt that I saw the occupation being carried out with, the contempt with which U.S. forces are carrying out this occupation. The fact that they're using Saddam's old palaces, Paul Bremer, who's the American viceroy in Iraq, essentially, he's Washington's man in Baghdad, he lives in one of Saddam's old palaces. The U.S. government has set up shop in old Ba'athist Party headquarters. One of the most glaring examples of contempt that I saw was when we drove past the Al-Shaheed Monument. This is a really big and majestic sculpture, and it's a memorial to the soldiers who died in the Iran-Iraq War. And like I said, every family in Iraq lost someone in this war. So it has incredible emotional significance. The only thing comparable, I think, in our country is the Vietnam Wall. And so this is really important to people. And as we drove past it, we could see that it was occupied by the U.S. So it's a U.S. base now. And so it's such a desecration. So the contempt with which the occupying forces are running this occupation really trickles down, I think, to a lot of the soldiers who are there. That if you have these U.S. soldiers, young kids my age, who joined the army so they could get money for college or whatever, they were told that they would go to Iraq to liberate these people, to fight for freedom and to fight terrorism, and instead they're occupying the country. And not surprisingly, the Iraqis don't want them there, and so they're living in constant fear of attack. They're far from home. They're far from the people that they love in this foreign place. And a lot of them are taking out their frustration on Iraqis. And the contempt with which the U.S. is running the occupation, you can see how easily it infects these troops. And so when I was there, I saw soldiers driving by and pointing their guns at children on the street. We heard stories of soldiers driving tanks down the street and giving the finger to anyone who happened to be on the street. So it's this kind of really harsh treatment. And then you have the treatment, you know, you have these soldiers breaking down doors, screaming at grown women to get up out of bed and go out on the street. It's this kind of treatment that I would argue is feeding the Iraqi resistance right now. We're told that there's an argument from the Bush administration that the resistance is being fueled by terrorists, or by al-Qaeda, by Iranians who are sneaking over the border and pulling the strings of this resistance. But it's actually, it's this really harsh treatment that's pushing Iraqis to resist the occupation. Most of the Iraqis I met, the vast majority, were willing to give the U.S. the benefit, well, a lot of them were willing to give the U.S. the benefit of the doubt, but the vast majority didn't want to confront the U.S. You know, they were trying to avoid confrontation, but they found themselves confronted. Either we met one family whose son was coming home from work one day, and he was passing a demonstration of Iraqis against the occupation, and U.S. troops opened fire, and he was killed in the crossfire. Now that family is obviously really, you know, really angry with U.S. occupying forces. I also talked to students at the University of Baghdad who were on campus going to classes and whatnot, and then U.S. troops show up with their guns, and they start walking around the campus like they own the place. And it's people who are trying to avoid confrontation but being confronted every day by this occupation, that's what's pushing people into the resistance. And one thing that I heard that really stuck with me was this professor who we spoke with he's a psychology professor, and we were speaking with a group of them, and these are academics who are talking about psychology and the psychological impact of the occupation, the impact of this occupation on Iraqi people's dignity. And so this professor told us about the indignities of living under occupation, and he concluded by saying, you know, sooner or later we'll all be part of the resistance. That's a pretty big statement. I mean, imagine hearing that from a professor, you know, in the United States. But that's the extent to which people are being pushed to oppose the U.S. occupation. And that's why I think that we in the United States need to build an anti-war movement that calls for an end to the occupation. Not a transferring of the occupation to so another country can run the same thing. Not a transferring of it to another body like the United Nations, but an end. We need to bring the troops home and let the Iraqis decide how to run their own country. Right now, the United Nations is sending a mission to Iraq. They have a mission in Iraq to find out whether or not Iraq is ready for self-government, whether or not they can have democracy. And I heard on the radio news, they were talking about how one of the factors for whether that may be an obstacle to self-government is that Iraq doesn't have a democratic culture. Like, as if the United States has a democratic culture. You know, I think that we really can't accept the idea that these people don't know how to govern themselves. I think that's a really racist idea, particularly look at who it's coming from. We have the United States, led by George Bush, who wasn't elected, and he's going to go to Iraq to tell them how to have democracy. I mean, that's really absurd, and I think that we have to disagree with that and argue that Iraqis have a right to run their own country and that the U.S. needs to leave. In order to build that kind of movement, one of the big lessons that I learned when I was in Iraq is about the importance of organization. I met a lot of people. I met doctors and students and professors and teachers and a lot of just ordinary people on the street. And they have all kinds of ideas. Some of them are against the occupation but don't think the U.S. should leave right away. Others are against the occupation and say the U.S. should leave yesterday. There are others who are against the occupation and say Saddam should come back. He wasn't so bad compared to this. Others are against the occupation but don't want Saddam to come back. So there are all kinds of political ideas. But the vast majority of people I met are not involved in any kind of organization or party that opposes the occupation, whether it's a student organization or political organization. They're just not organized. And unless they get themselves organized, all they can do is comment on what's happening to them. That is, unless people get organized, all we can do is be commentators on the history that's made for or against us. And that's something that I really, a sense that I really got in Iraq, and the importance of actually pulling together. I want to move toward closing, and I told you a lot of depressing things. It was a pretty depressing trip in a lot of ways, but there were some inspiring things too, and I want to close with a story that I found on one hand kind of heartbreaking, but in another way kind of inspiring too. And it's about a conversation that I had with a young woman named Kitas. She's 16 years old and she lives in Baghdad, and on the night I was talking to her, she was really depressed. She was telling me about how her whole life has been war. She was born in 1987, during the last year of the Iran-Iraq War. When she was a toddler, the U.S. invaded in 1991, and you had the 13 years of economic sanctions and routine bombing. And now you had this invasion. She told me about how when the U.S. invaded Baghdad, when they got there, her and her sister and her mother cried for days. You know, to see U.S. troops rolling down the streets in her hometown was just really devastating. And she's seen really horrible things since the invasion and occupation. When I talked to her, she had just recently saw a dead body for the first time, and that was a traumatic experience. And she was telling me about that. And so she was really depressed and telling me about how she has dreams, but they're just so hard to, it's hard to imagine them being realized right now. She has dreams of growing up and being a doctor, of leaving Iraq. She said that she wants to live in a place that doesn't have oil. She talked about how oil is supposed to be a blessing, but really it's just been a curse to the Iraqi people. And so she was telling me all this depressing stuff about her life and about how she has a real hopelessness for her future. And I could tell that she wanted me to say something reassuring, and I'm thinking, what can I say in this situation? You know, she has this hopelessness, but there's a real reason for this hopelessness. So I told her that I can see why she feels so hopeless. I mean, the reality is really, it's overwhelming. But that she can't let the occupiers take her dreams away, because if they do that, then they've won. You know, they've taken her country, they take control over her life, but you have to hold on to your dreams. And she told me, but what can I dream? It's like, it's so hard to even imagine, you know, fulfilling my dreams in this situation. And I said, well, you didn't get to choose to live under this occupation. You know, you didn't get to choose the situation that you're in. Most of us don't get to choose what situation that we're in. But the choices that we make within that situation, as limited as they can be, that's something that belongs to us. You know, that's something that they can't take away from you. You can make that choice. And she asked, well, what choice can I make? And I said, whatever choice you want to make. And she said, well, then I choose resistance. Which, you know, it's so courageous of a 16-year-old young woman to say. And I told her that I choose resistance too. And I guess what I'm asking you tonight is to join us in this resistance. What there's really lacking in Iraq is an organized political opposition that has a base with the population. There is an armed resistance, but it's not connected with the actual population. It's all underground. And what they need is an organized resistance to pull it all together and establish a base among ordinary Iraqi people. And I think that we need the same thing in the United States. We need an opposition too. And we need a real opposition. I think it's important to say what we need right now, it isn't just about finding someone to vote for to do it for us, because they're not going to. You know, we're in an election year, and all of the Democratic candidates support the occupation. So it's not about finding someone to make this fight for us. I think that that's our job. And that means that I think we have to get involved wherever we are. So if you go to RIT, I encourage you to get involved in RIT anti-war. If you don't go to RIT, you know, get involved where you are. But what we need right now is that kind of movement where we're actually involved and we're talking these things through and making these decisions. In closing, we, both in Iraq and the United States, need both action and a discussion about how to fight this U.S. aggression and imperialism. We need a discussion about how to fight for the right of an occupied people to take control of their country and of their lives. In the process of us doing that here in this country, in the process of us having that discussion, we're going to assert our own right to take control of our country and of our lives. So that's all I have to say.